This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We've talked about some pretty important topics this year, and as 2014 winds down, we thought we'd take a couple of weeks and revisit some that really got your attention and lit up our inbox. We'll start with a show from February. 4 or 5 decades ago, a college education wasn't really worth that much. Sure, getting a degree opened a lot of doors, and many parents encouraged their children to continue their education. But there were plenty of well-paying jobs waiting for people with just a high school diploma or less.
The dramatic changes in the American economy have increased the skills American workers need to earn a decent living.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear again from the authors of the book Restoring Opportunity, and find out why the value of a college degree has skyrocketed since the 70s. We'll also spend an academic minute with Dickens' Glowing Lobsters. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Economics and education go together. In fact, according to the book Restoring Opportunity, The Crisis of Inequality and the Challenge for American Education, they are linked together now more than ever. Back in February, we had a conversation with the authors of that book, trying to learn a bit more about how the changing economy of the past 4 decades have made education more important than ever. Greg Duncan is Distinguished Professor in the Department of Education at the University of California, Irvine. Richard Murnane is an economist, the Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. The first question was to Dr. Murnane, simply, why this topic and why now?
The why now comes from the dramatic changes in the American economy that have increased the skills American workers need to earn a decent living. 40 years ago, there were a lot of jobs in manufacturing, back offices in banks and insurance companies where you could earn a decent living basically following directions. Those are the tasks that are easiest to computerize, and as a result of which, those jobs have to a large extent disappeared. There are several consequences of these dramatic labor market changes, one of which is increases in the role of education in determining how much one earns in the labor market, and that has contributed to rapid increases in family income inequality. Those families that have 2 adults with college degrees are doing quite well. Those families in which the adults do not have strong educational credentials and strong skills are not doing very well at all. And that pattern has serious implications for the opportunities for children growing up in low-income families.
One of the things we discovered from research done by Sean Reardon, who's a sociologist at Stanford, is over this period of increasing income inequality, the gap between the test scores of low-income kids and high-income kids has increased quite dramatically. And another piece of research has shown that that translates into attainment differences, college graduation rates for kids in low and high income families. That gap has increased as well. So we're really introducing an element that's driving a wedge, a widening wedge, between the future prospects, labor market prospects for high and low income kids.
Has that gap in graduation rates between high and low income, is it about the background of the kids growing up with low income, or is it just that they can't afford college and have to start working?
It's some of both, but they really go together. The fact that the 15 million children growing up in families in the bottom 20% of the family income distribution, they have about 25% less family income corrected for inflation than comparable families had in the 1970s. So there is less money to pay for college. There also is less money for child enrichment. One of the quite striking changes that Greg and I found is that the gap between what high-income families, that is at the 80th percentile, families spend on child enrichment per child, and what low-income families spend, again, we're talking about 15 million children in each group, has grown from a difference of about $3,000 in today's prices to a gap of $8,000. And one reason that matters is that the kind of experiences money can pay for, high-quality childcare, summer vacations, internships, trips abroad help high-income children develop the knowledge, the background, vocabulary, and the self-confidence that are increasingly important both to succeed in schooling and also in labor markets. So the increase in income inequality has led to increased gaps in preparation to succeed in school.
We're not saying that income is the only thing that's determining these kind of outcomes, because at the same time that income inequality has increased, there's been this increase in single-parent family structure among low-income families, which has probably played a role. And just the education levels, the higher education levels in higher-income families, independent of income, is probably going to play a role as well. But we were particularly interested in what role income had, because income is the one measure of inputs to kids that one can change most easily through state policy and federal policy.
So it's not only that income matters directly through what families can spend on their children. There's strikingly good evidence from Sean Reardon that increasing family income inequality has led to increasing residential segregation by income, not by race, but by income. In other words, low-income families are more likely to have neighbors who are low-income today than was the case 30 years ago. And the reason that matters is that most children still go to school close to where they live. So as a result of which, increasing residential segregation by income has led to increasing school segregation by income over the last several decades. And that matters in terms of the quality of education those schools are able to provide children. And we use this term high poverty schools. There are three mechanisms through which increasing concentration of kids, of low-income kids in high-poverty schools matters. First of all, those children are more likely to have classmates with achievement problems and behavioral problems, and these peer group effects affect the quality of instruction. Second, they're more likely to experience more student mobility during the school year, and there's nice work from Chicago showing that children, not only those who move, but even those who stay in schools in which there's a lot of student mobility, don't learn as much. And the mechanism is pretty straightforward. If you've got a new child entering the class every couple of weeks, it takes a lot of the teacher's time to figure out what reading group the child should be in, help the child understand the norms of behavior, and that's time taken away from instruction. And the third point is that it's hard for high-poverty schools to attract and retain skilled teachers. So for all these mechanisms, the increasing income inequality has led to greater challenges in providing high-quality education to low-income children.
You point out in the book where there are some schools in low-income areas that are success stories, that do have that sparkling leader who can take a school and make it successful, but you say that it's really hard to maintain that.
That's right. Leadership is important, but we can't build up a national system of effective schools if we require that every school leader be as charismatic as the best of them are. So what we tried to do was to look through the evaluation literature, the really strong studies looking at education programs, and identify a preschool system, which was in Boston, a system of charter schools, which was in Chicago, and then a small high school movement that produced more than 200 small high schools in New York City. So in all cases, the students being served were largely low income, largely minority, but in all cases, the programs that were put in place were proven to be effective. And they weren't driven by a charismatic leader. They were driven by a very systematic focus on improving the quality of the instruction that was taking place in the classrooms.
So one thing, if you ask, what do these interventions have in common? I mean, first of all, importantly, as Greg mentioned, they're not single schools. They are interventions that affect considerably more than one school. In Chicago, there's about 68 schools that have these participate in this effective pre-K program, and it's about 200 small schools. So there's scale. The other thing, perhaps most important, all of these interventions are characterized by a combination of consistently strong school supports and sensible accountability. So So by consistently strong school supports, we mean, for example, good curricula, lots of coaching for staff so that they can learn to teach the curriculum effectively, opportunities, scheduled opportunities in the school day for faculty to meet with each other to improve teaching, to make it more consistent. And sensible accountability, we mean accountability that to take advantage of the opportunities to improve instruction. For example, in the Boston Pre-K program, all of the schools are being asked to try and get National Association of the Education of Young Children certification, which is a 3-year process really designed to improve standards. And we emphasize this term sensible accountability as opposed to what accountability looks like in lots of states. A sensible accountability is an accountability system that makes it attractive for skilled teachers to work in high-poverty schools.
A lot is made about how much money is spent per child in schools in the U.S., and it's gone up quite a bit in the 4 decades we're talking about. Does that really matter, or is it how it's spent?
Well, I think they go together in the sense that, historically, a strategy to improve education in high-poverty schools was to provide more funds. Title I, the federal program, of course, is a common thing. The temptation is to use extra money, however, in ways that don't result in changes in the activities of the classroom teachers and don't result in fundamental changes in children's daily experiences. For example, hiring tutors to do a pull-out program. So you're not changing core instruction, you're just adding something to the day. After-school programs the same way. Buying technology, having a computer lab, without changing the core instruction. So those things don't change children's daily experiences and consequently don't lead to better education. And that doesn't mean that money doesn't matter. In all of the interventions we highlight, there are systematic strategies to make instruction consistently better and to enrich children's experiences. In many cases, that cost extra money, but the dollars follow after a good plan is put in place to improve instruction and make it more consistent.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Greg Duncan and Dr. Richard Murnane about their book Restoring Opportunity continues with a look at how opportunity has changed over the past 4 decades. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1266. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Dr. Greg Duncan, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Education at the University of California, Irvine, and Dr. Richard Murnane, an economist, the Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We're replaying a conversation from February about their book, Restoring Opportunity, The Crisis of Inequality and the Challenge for American Education.
Want to go into, the title of the book, of course, Restoring Opportunity. How has opportunity changed in these past 4 or 5 decades?
Well, with increasing income inequality, if you think about opportunity as in an intergenerational context, the opportunity for a child growing up in a working class family or a poor family to grow up and have a decent paying middle-class job, the opportunity to do better than your parents did. It's really the American dream, and for many generations in America, increasing overall levels of education and the economic prosperity made that dream a reality for many, many families. One of the things that we also document is the extent to which children are less likely to do better than their parents in terms of completed schooling, certainly. I think we know the most about that. You know, up until about 30 years ago, there was this steady increase in the amount of education that sons had relative to their fathers, that daughters had relative to their mothers. And that's been reversed in the last couple of decades. So it's this trend toward less of the attainment of the American dream that's accompanied this increasing income inequality.
It is not the case that the skills low-income children leave school with are lower than they were several decades ago. In fact, we know from the National Assessment of Educational Progress that's not true. Scores have improved, particularly for minority group members. But the problem is they haven't improved nearly enough, given the changes in the economy, to prepare low-income children to succeed in acquiring the skills and the educational attainments that high-wage employers are looking for.
So is college the gateway to better, you know, a better opportunity? Is that the best path or the only path?
I think it's certainly one of the most certain paths. And if you actually translate the gaps into what fractions of kids graduate from college, used to be the case back in the 70s that kids in the bottom 25% of the income distribution, 5% of them would actually complete 4 years of college. In the top 25%, it was 36%. Quite a gap, but of course, high-income kids do have advantages. If you roll the motion picture forward to kids who were adolescents in the late 90s, that 5% had gone up to 9%, almost doubled. That's significant progress. But the 36% has gone up to 54%. So the gap in the college graduation rates has increased substantially between high and low-income families. So there's, even though low-income kids have made progress, they've fallen back relative to high-income kids, and they've fallen back relative to the skills that are really required by the new jobs in the 21st century.
The only pathway is not a four-year college degree. There are lots of what sometimes I'll call new artisans jobs that require some post-secondary education or training that don't require a four-year degree. For example, the jobs of technicians who work for the cable and TV companies, those jobs require considerable training, and so the employers are looking for individuals who have the strong literacy skills to be able to learn efficiently, to make sense of new vocabulary. Those jobs that don't require a four-year degree for the most part, but they do require the ability to solve problems, the ability to communicate effectively. For example, in conversations we've had with some of these folks who do this work, they point out, you know, one of the challenges, you have to ask the right questions so that the consumer can provide information about what's really going wrong. And then another piece of the communications challenge is when you finally figure out the problem is that the consumer, often an elderly consumer, doesn't really know how to work his TV, if the problem is cable TV, how do you explain to this person that the problem isn't with the system? And that has to be done, of course, delicately. And that's a real communication challenge.
Well, what are the building blocks then? The building blocks of successful school reform. What can we do?
We've talked about some of them, the kind of supports that schools need to extend to teachers, sensible accountability, taking advantage of the latest research. I think one of the other building blocks that we are strongly in favor of are the Common Core State Standards. They are grade-by-grade learning goals in order to get kids in 12th grade graduating from high school with these kinds of skills that we've been talking about.
So I could add a couple of things to these list of building blocks. One, Greg mentioned research knowledge. Well, we really have learned a great deal over the last couple of decades about what instruction has to look like in schools to effectively teach all children to master these higher standards, and particularly important in high-poverty schools. For example, we know much more about child development, what healthy child development looks like. We know more about adolescent development. We know more about what good professional development for classroom teachers requires. For example, we know that the skills to become a literate person English fiction are quite different from those in science, are quite different from those in social studies, as a result of which teaching literacy skills is not simply the work of the English teacher. It has to be the job of all teachers working together. The real challenge is to develop systems that consistently provide to all schools this combination of strong supports and sensible accountability. That really is a challenge for the United States. It's been very hard to make that happen. The one kind of modest encouragement is the increasing density of not-for-profit organizations that are designed to provide support to schools. For example, the Boston Teacher Residency trains teachers in a very hands-on way on new leaders for new schools, the New York Leadership Academy. So all those are doing a nice job of supporting schools. I think a challenge is how to provide systems of support, including funding, so that it will be easy for schools to access the kind of supports they need to meet new accountability standards.
Greg Duncan is Distinguished Professor in the Department of Education at the University of California, Irvine. Richard Murnane is an economist, the Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Their book is called Restoring Opportunity: The Crisis of Inequality and the Challenge for American Education. If you've read the Charles Dickens holiday classic, A Christmas Carol, you've come across a passage about a glowing lobster. So, just what the heck is that? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Dickens' classic, A Christmas Carol, remains a holiday favorite even after 170 years. Ken Knoll, professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of Connecticut, explains one of the book's most obscure descriptions that might be lost on the modern reader.
A Christmas tradition in many families is a reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. The story is filled with memorable phrases like Tiny Tim's, "God bless us, everyone," and of course Ebenezer Scrooge grumbling, "Bah, humbug." The next time you read it, listen for a passage that is memorable in its own odd way. You'll come to the part where Scrooge goes home and sees the face of his deceased partner Marley in his door knocker. The story says, "Marley's face, it was not an impenetrable shadow as the other objects in the yard were, but had a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar." What are glowing lobsters doing in A Christmas Carol? And how do we know they are bad? In Dickens' day, lobsters were stored in damp basements where they could go bad when bacteria grew on them. A bacterium called Vibrio grows on lobster shells, consuming the sugar chitin that composes the shell. The Vibrio species that does this also glows in the dark by a process called bioluminescence, thus Dickens's glowing bad lobsters. Bioluminescent Vibrios also live in the ocean. Some grow inside the skin pouches of certain fish and squid. They create light to help the animals avoid predators by blending them with the moonlit water of shallow lagoons. Other vibrios live in the light organs of deep-sea fish, helping them lure prey in their dark homes. Though Dickens did not know it, these glowing bacteria added a different kind of mystery to Mr. Scrooge's Christmas Eve adventures.
That was Ken Knoll of the University of Connecticut. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.